Welcome to the Replay Value Podcast, where we deep dive into the movies we all love to watch over and over again. I'm Phil, joined by my brother from the same mother, our co-host on the West Coast, Warren.
What's up, bro? In this episode, we're going to talk about the fantasy adventure blockbuster, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Harry, Ron, and Hermione return to Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry for their third year of study, where he is informed that a prisoner named Sirius Black has escaped from Azkaban and intends to kill him.
I love Harry Potter. Started reading the books around the time that the first films were coming out. Jumped on the bandwagon, I would say, pretty early, all things considered. But this one always held a special place in my heart. Number one, The first two films are more kid-oriented, for you know, they're children's movies. This is the first leap into maturity, but it also has the time travel element. So there was a lot of cool things that really spoke to me as a fan. The nerdiness of Harry Potter, but intermingled with those other aspects, has made it one of my franchise favorites for many years.
Yeah, the distinction it made from the previous two films, it carved a different path for the franchise and ultimately elevated the rest of the films. You know, with the development of the third Harry Potter film, the Harry Potter film switched to an 18-month production cycle to give each film the time it required to make it good.
Well, again, the first two films, they're more children's movies. And part of the reason for that and the shorter production cycle is they're shorter books. So to truly do the third and beyond justice, I mean, there was a point to where every Harry Potter book that came out, it was gradually bigger and bigger than the previous one. I think Order of the Phoenix was capped out in length, and then they went slightly down after that. But, I mean, all of them were substantially longer than the first two. So it did take more time to develop them, work on the script. But it was also just hard on the cast and crew. I mean, Chris Columbus did the first two films, you know, mainly known for a lot of childhood favorites, Home Alone, Mrs. Doubtfire. And he didn't see his family and his kids for like 2.5 years while he was working on the first two Harry Potter films. So it was a mixture of giving the cast and crew a break and also wanting to do the development justice.
Yeah, so he opted not to return for the third one. And some director what-ifs. Guillermo del Toro almost took the reins. Mark Foster was in contention as director. M. Night Shyamalan and Ken Branagh were also in talks to direct before Alfonso Cuarón took the reins.
Well, Kenneth Branagh was Gilderoy Lockhart in the second film, which I love. I mean, one of a great character in that movie. So, but he did do a lot of directing. So, yeah, Warner Brothers and the producers, they knew going into this, which Chris Columbus did stay on to produce, did have an idea this one would take a darker tone. And so Del Toro wanted to, but his vision didn't quite align. And I think he had a lot to do with Alfonso Cuarón getting recommended for that and eventually getting it. They were friends. He got him to read the books, which Alfonso had never done before. So he was reluctant to sign on to direct.
Once he read the books, he connected to the story and he agreed to do it. This was his fifth feature film, his third studio picture. Before this, he did A Little Princess in 95 and Great Expectations in 98 with Gwyneth Paltrow and Ethan Hawke. I went and saw that in theaters. That was a pretty big film. And then afterwards, Children of Men in 2006. That is a fucked up movie. And then Gravity in 2013, he won two Oscars, Best Director, Best Editing. And then he won two more Oscars with Roma in 2018, Best Director, Best Cinematography. So, I mean, this guy can do it all.
Yeah, he actually did do Itumama Tambien, which is very much spiritually connected to this film because it's about a transition from, you know, childhood to adulthood or being a kid to an adult. This one, be a Prisoner of Azkaban, is the kid's transition, you know, kind of developing from children to teenagers and that lifestyle. And so he is somewhat of, was an expert and really had a pulse on how to portray that on film very well. I checked to see what he's doing next. I was like, what? I mean, he hadn't done a ton of films, all things considered, in, you know, the 20 plus years he's been active. He's actually working on a TV series called Ascension, which is very tight-lipped right now. Not a lot is known about it, but I'm excited. So very fantastic director. Was shocked that Harry Potter was able to land him. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, with approaching this project, you know, just like the books got bigger, well, he wanted this film to be larger in scope, grounded in the real world. And he stuck to the book's spirit, but he did opt, as you mentioned earlier, a darker tone. He wanted a naturalistic contemporary film. A lot more thought was put into that kind of stuff. Even like with the costumes, for example, in the first couple of films, they were always wearing the academia robes. And Karan was like, well, no, if their parents aren't around or teachers aren't around, they're not in class, they're just going to wear street clothes. And so there was a lot more like having the kids dress like parents aren't around or how they would want to.
Yeah. So yeah, in the first two films, you're right. They'd wear their house robes and they were always very, you know, polished and proper, you know, buttoned up and ties nice and everything. And this one, it's just like, well, you know, the kids are going to wear them loose when they're not around, you know, so the kids got to, you know, mess around with how they wore their robes, very kind of slouchy, like a kid would wear, you know. And
exactly,
they even got J.K. Rowling's blessing as far as wearing street clothes outside of class, because that's what kids would do. They wouldn't keep wearing their house robes. Yeah,
yeah. So that was a very to make it more realistic, I think that creatively that was a great change from the first two pictures. And even the lighting, it was if you notice, it's moodier, it has more shadows. I mean, it's just the material has a darker tone, and visually it literally has a darker tone.
Yeah. There's not as many close-up shots or kind of shot further back, so you can get pick up on more body language and just, you know, more of the lifestyle of, like, you know, what a kid or a, you know, a teenager would be. So they created a lot of real sets, you know, for Hogsmeade, for the Three Broomsticks, Hagrid's Hut, which they, you know, they hadn't done previously, so it was completely...
Well, this is the first Harry Potter film to extensively use real-world locations. I mean, the first two were mostly shot on sound stages in studio.
Yeah, they actually did the whole night bus sequence in London. I read how they did that, like, because the night bus is like zooming through there 100 miles an hour. I'm like, how did they do this in London? Well, what they did is they shot it with the night bus going 30 miles per hour, and everything on set was stunt doubles, or, you know, stunt drivers, stunt men, stunt women, the pedestrians, whatnot, were all stunt people. The other cars were driving at 8 miles per hour, and the stunt people were trained to walk in slow motion, so that when they sped everything up, it kept the ratio correct to where it would look like the bus at 30 miles per hour was going 100. Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's some great creative ingenuity in filmmaking to get the shot in camera that you want. They did use a lot of CGI in this movie, but obviously they got a lot of that particular sequence. They captured it in camera.
Well, they used CGI when they had to, but like they wanted to go to more puppetry and like real life effects, like you mentioned earlier. Like I remember the first
two wanted films, to do that, but the ILM was so good, they showed him stuff that they weren't able to accomplish in camera, getting a metaphysical look. I mean, it was just really hard to get that. Without some CGI, yeah.
Certain things, but I will give this film credit where I really can't for the first two films. There were some CGI portions where, I don't know if it was Quidditch or with the troll in the first one, there were certain times where it kind of had that rubbery CGI look that I kind of associate with The Matrix Reloaded, you know, where it looked awesome at the time, but it doesn't age well. There's a fakeness to it, whereas Prisoner of Azkaban holds up much better in that regard.
That's why the great directors tend to want to use real sets like they did on this, because your movie's going to age a lot better if you do. Filming began February 24, 2003 at Leavesden Film Studios, and it wrapped in late November 2003. So, what, about 7 months of shooting, 7.5? I haven't read the book. I know you've read all of them multiple times, but I'm sure there are a number of differences between the movie and the book.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Warren, because I was waiting on it. No, I have read this book especially several times, and it's been a few years, but I'm looking forward to reading it again. My kids are just right on the cusp, I feel like, of being ready for Harry Potter reading. They're 5 and 6 years old, so they might be ready for Chamber of Secrets soon. But anyway.
Probably show them the movie here pretty soon, yeah.
Oh, they love the movies, but they focus more on Sorcerer's Stone and Chamber of Secrets. The first two, Prisoner of Azkaban, when we were watching this, my five-year-old's just like, I fast forwarded through the werewolf, he scares me, you know. and then he's like, wait, no, I'm okay, pause it, let me look at him. But it's funny, it's more it's dark, more mature, but anyway. Yeah, there are several differences between the book versus film. Not going to be able to cover them all, but I'll cover some of the ones that just jumped out at me as a fan. The Marauder's Map creators are not explained. So it's like Masters Mooney, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs. And I don't know if you know this, Warren, but that is a reference to Remus Lupin, Mooney, who is a werewolf, the moon, Wormtail, the rat, who Peter Pettigrew turns into a rat, Padfoot, the Padfoot of a dog, which Sirius turns into, and Prongs, the antlers for the animal that James Potter turns into. So it's all of their animagus forms that they gave nicknames to. It's not explained in the film at all, but they are the creators of the Marauder's Map. Lupin, Sirius, James, and you know, his friends.
Would it have just been too exposition-y in the movie? There just wasn't an opportunity to explain it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you hint at it because Lupin, you can tell he has a familiarity with the map. He covers for Harry, and you know he does use it in a way to feel like you know there's some connection there. There's this a lot of things were cut as far as Sirius's backstory, the Scabbers, the rat, and like the class times. A lot of that is cut down for time. Harry had a crush. His first crush was on the student named Cho Chang from Ravenclaw. That's first brought up in this film, in this book, but they don't actually show it in the films until Goblet of Fire, the next movie. Again, cut for time. There's a great scene. Man, I really wish they would have left this in. A great scene between Snape and Harry where Snape essentially lectures Harry on his dad and why he didn't like him. And it explains the motivation of why Snape it puts that motivation there in such a strong way that you knew existed, but explains it why in a great way. Lastly, there is this disconnect or this tension between Harry and Ron against Hermione in the books where like Ron goes like 6 months without talking to Hermione because their animal, he thinks that her cat ate his rat, not realizing the rat had run away because it's Peter Pettigrew. And because she's always gone with you know, using the time turner to get to class, there's this tension between the three, the characters that of course resolves itself at the end, but is completely absent from the film. Again, I get why they cut it, but it's such an important part of the book that it's disappointing they have to cut those for time. It's almost you wish in some sense, like they need to make a Harry Potter television series just so you get the visualization.
Well, now today it would have been a series. Yeah. I don't think they would have made 8 movies like this.
It worked great for the first two films, but when you get to these longer, more nuanced subplots and stuff like that, and the third books and beyond, there's a lot that is lost. But anyway, there's many, many more differences. Those are just a few that were
some of the bigger ones for sure. Yeah.
For me, yeah, exactly.
Some classic references, and great directors always reference great cinema of the past. Some oldies here. Phantom of the Opera, 1925. All About Even from 1950. The 400 Blows from 1959. The Time Machine from 1960. The Meaning of Life from 83. Now, here's a few of my favorites, though. Batman Returns from 1992. With the line, "Help us, old lady, at 12 o'clock." That's from Batman Begins. From Army of Darkness, 1992. Harry's book with teeth attacks him, just like from Army of Darkness.
Well, the Monster Book of Monsters. I mean, that book is that way in the book, in the book version of Prisoner of Azkaban.
Evil
too,
Dead, so. Though. Come on, yeah. It's a visually, okay. it's straight out.
Visually,
Evil Dead.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Forrest Gump, Buck Beak's Feather in the Wind, and Titanic with Buck Beak and Harry flying over the water scene. I mean, that's very reminiscent of some Titanic.
That's a loose reference there. I'm going to call BS on that one, but I get you.
What, on the Titanic one?
The Titanic one,
The Forrest Gump Buckbeat feather for sure.
Anytime you see a feather flying in the wind like that, yeah, it's you think of
Forrest Gump.
Yeah, Forrest Gump, yeah. But very quickly, music of the film. This was the last Harry Potter film that was composed by the great John Williams, which I was surprised. I mean, there is the Lumos Hedwig's theme that that is from the first two films, but it was not. This was the last original version, I would say, that was used in a film until the end credits of Deathly Hallows Part 2. A part of the reason for that is because the films took so much of a darker, more mature
darker tone. And Williams exactly. had a much more lighter fanfare.
So Goblet of Fire, book four or film four was composed by Patrick Doyle. Five and six were done by Nicholas Hooper. And then seven and eight were done by Alexander Desplat. So they did jump around from composer for the remaining five films that were made.
Pretty wild that we just did Jaws with John Williams, and then we're doing a completely different movie from like almost 30 years later. And wouldn't you know it, John Williams scored that one too. Nominated for an Oscar for both of them. And it might be the first film where we've had a same composer do back-to-back movies like this.
Possibly, but if there's anyone that was going to do it, it would be John Williams. So, fantastic score. One of the best of 2004, called out by many critics. Just the fact that he was able to make an already great score for Harry Potter even greater. One of the big call outs as far as new music for this one was Double Trouble. Interesting fact about that is that the lyrics were taken directly from Macbeth. But that was also composed by John Williams, believe it or not, and you know, meant to be sung by a children's choir. Those movies, man, some of my favorite film scores out there, this one included.
And we move on to the stars of the picture.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
One hell of an ensemble cast. Three Oscar winners, one BAFTA winner and one nominee, and one Emmy winner and two nominees. So many decorated actors and so many familiar faces that we know and love from so many other movies. But actors with this much pedigree, I think, gave the Potter franchise an added credibility.
This is the ensemble cast of ensemble casts is for Harry Potter. You can't, all the adult actors in it for the professors and just the parents and what have you, they're just, I mean, they're so good. So that was the most difficult thing for us when we went down to narrow it down. Okay, I don't know how many other Harry Potters we're going to do on the podcast. How many episodes would we have to do of Recasting Court to do it justice? I mean, narrowing it down for that was so impossible because you want to do ones that are important to this film, but also that honor the franchise as a whole without it being 50 actors long. It's just such a fantastic list of thespians.
Yeah, starting at the top of the call sheet with Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter, his fourth movie. But the first Harry Potter was his second film. He did The Tailor of Panama with Pierce Brosnan in 2001. And funny enough, Jamie Lee Curtis, that was his mom in the film, she told Daniel Radcliffe's real-life mother that your kid could play Harry Potter. And wouldn't you know it, that's what ended up happening.
Wow.
Lots of plays as a kid. I mean, Daniel Radcliffe has been a seasoned stage actor, not as only as an adult, but I mean, he's been doing it since he was a kid.
He's a great actor, and I'm glad to see that he has been able to move beyond. I mean, he's always going to be Harry Potter, but I love him in the show Miracle Workers. I don't know if you've ever seen it. He's hilarious. He's got great comedic chops. He's an incredibly good actor.
Yeah, they first spotted him when they saw him in David Copperfield. That's when the producers of the movie he got on their radar to play Harry Potter. The parents, however, at first were reluctant before ultimately agreeing.
I mean, yeah, I get it, the reluctance, but you gotta get that Harry Potter money. I mean, come on, baby.
I mean, he's already doing plays. Might as well throw him in a film, right? Come on.
Yeah.
Emma Watson as Hermione Granger. This was her third movie. Harry Potter was her first. The very first Harry Potter movie was her first movie. So at this point, she had only done the three Harry Potter films. Her Oxford theater teacher passed her name to casting agents, and she had to go through five interviews before landing the role. Her self-confidence is what, at the end of the day, that's what separated her from the hundreds of other kids that auditioned.
And it makes sense, and that comes across on the screen, is that, you know, Hermione is, you know, very much confident in her, and for good reason. She's very intelligent, and yeah, Emma Watson portrays it perfectly.
And I think with child actors, they probably bring them in for more, even more interviews than they normally would, because you really have to make sure if you're going to trust them with your movie that they can consistently show up and do it.
Especially for the main three, Harry, Ron, and Hermione. I mean, going into this, I mean, the casting net had been cast very wide. And you look at a lot of kids that are going to, I mean, you going into this, you know, you're going to carry an entire franchise.
Yeah. And Rupert Grint as Ron Weasley. This was his third movie, just like Emma Watson. The only movies he'd done up to this point were Harry Potter. And, you know, he responded to an open casting call with a video of himself rapping about, getting the part, and the casting director saw it, that got him an audition, and ultimately he ended up booking the part, which is kind of crazy. I mean, he just took the initiative at a young age and got his foot in the door.
Well, yeah, I mean, Ron would do something that stupid. Ron Weasley would.
Kind of in character.
Yeah, and speaking of which, you know, coming into this film, Alfonso Cuarón was like, okay, you know, you've played these characters for the first two movies, but you need to know who they are, where they came from. He asked Daniel Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Rupert Grint to write essays about their character from birth to getting into Hogwarts, you know, what their experience was. And Daniel Radcliffe, in an interview, talked about, you know, he turned in his first. He wrote a full page about it. He was so proud of it because he beat Emma and Rupert from turning theirs in for their characters. And the next day, Emma Watson turned in 16 and a half pages on Hermione, and he's just like, geez, what the hell? And then,
like, in character, like, yeah. true to form.
And then Ron, Rupert Grint didn't turn one in at all. And Alfonso's like, you know, where's your essay? He's just like, well, you know, I figured, you know, Ron would do anything he could to get out of actually doing homework, so I didn't do it. And he's just like, you know what? You understand your character. That's perfect. So,
yeah, well, they'd already been doing them. And I had kind of covered the casting stories of how they got the parts, because all eight movies were shot consecutively. So, I mean, they went from Philosopher's Stone or Sorcerer's Stone right into Chamber of Secrets, and from Chamber of Secrets right into Prisoner of Azkaban. So really all we have in Stars of the Picture is ultimately how they got the roles in the first place.
Except for, you know, the actors unique to this film, such as Gary Oldman as Sirius Black. Man, what a great cast.
27th movie, had his first credit in 1982, and this was just a year before he portrayed Gordon in Batman Begins.
That's
just
right.
Speaks to the range of Gary Oldman. Jesus. He is. It's known, or he said, that he took the role for money after a long hiatus with his family, but he was very surprised by the difficulty for a big franchise. He wasn't expecting it to be on par with some of the Shakespeare plays that he had done before.
Well, and see, I looked at that. I saw that in an interview where it was number one, he hadn't taken any major roles in a few years to spend time with his family and his kids. But I think it was more of just kind of a tongue-in-cheek joke about, you know, he needed the money, so he went on to a big franchise. It's fucking Gary Oldman, man. He didn't need the money. He took on the role because he wanted to work with Alfonso Cuarón. I mean, a great director is going to draw great actors to them. Number two, several of the actors in it, including Alan Rickman, Timothy Spall as Peter Pettigrew, and David Thewlis as Professor Lupin, he knew all these guys for decades. He was in theater with them, and he got the opportunity to share the screen with them. So that was part of it as well.
Yeah, and like you said, it's fucking Gary Oldman, and fucking Gary Oldman is the MVP. He gives the most valuable performance in the movie. You got to give it to him. I've used the... He's like Brando in Apocalypse Now. I mean, the movie is centered around him. It builds up to his appearance, and he does not disappoint. He just delivers the goods, as Gary Oldman always does. He surprises Harry and ultimately us, the audience. He's the heart and soul of the movie. I mean, some of the lines he gives anchors the emotional heart of the film, and the depth that he provides as Sirius Black helps with the payoff in the third act.
So in the first two films, you had a real villain. You had Voldemort's face on the back of Professor Quirrell's head or whatever in the first one. You had Tom Riddle's, a.k.a. Voldemort's, diary with the snake and the basilisk. In the second one, you had these real moments of climactic battle against a villain in the first two. This one, there really is no villain. It's somewhat of a red herring, because Sirius Black turns out to be a good guy and Harry's godfather. And man, Gary Oldman plays both sides of that so well. It's about a discovery of Harry's past. That's where the character evolution comes. That's where the climax comes with the time turn and everything. But Gary Oldman's portrayal of that, and just having the history with Lupin and Harry there, it just, there's so much emotion behind the character that you need a caliber actor like Oldman to pull it off.
Well, the runner-up in the MVP race would be David Thewlis as Remus Lupin. He accepted the role after more or less hearing word around the campfire, you know, amongst actors or in the industry, that Lupin was one of the best parts in the book. And so he like a good actor does, he sniffed out a potentially scene-stealing part. And he was Caron's first choice to play Lupin. He didn't have to audition. He was offered the role, and he took it. And, you know, he's so great in the part, and it just speaks to his range. Because, dude, like, what, a couple years ago, he played the villain in Wonder Woman, and it's like a completely different side of him. It was, wow, he's so good.
Yeah, he is an awesome actor. I love him. I mean, theatrically trained, you know, he's got the chops to come in. And all of these, the professors, the parents, in the Harry Potter film franchise do. I mean, they're all very talented. Quick funny thing about David Thewlis is he was Caron's first choice for Remus Lupin, but he auditioned for the role of Professor Quirrell in the first film and didn't get it. But just funny side note, Lupine, L-U-P-I-N-E, is Latin for wolf, and the dude's name is Remus Lupin. I mean, come on. Like, if that's not a giveaway, he's a werewolf, I don't know what is. Just that always cracked me up as a reader. Just
it's like common knowledge. I mean, come on. The ensemble, the list goes on and on and on. Real quick, some of the franchise mainstays. Robbie Coltrane as Rubeus Hagrid. He appeared in all 8 Harry Potter films. Mm-hmm. Michael Gambon as Albus Dumbledore. He appeared in 6 of the films. And the reason being, he took the part over from the late, great Richard Harris, who played the Dumbledore part in the first 2 Harry Potter films. Yeah,
going into this, he had said that, you know, he didn't want to do an impersonation of Richard Harris. He looked at the Dumbledore's character almost like King Lear. I mean, when you play King Lear on stage, you don't look at what the other actors have done. You give your own
interpretation. Yeah, you bring your own interpretation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he wanted to do that with Dumbledore. So, and Caron was on board with that. So, you know, whereas Richard Harris played a more of a majestic, quiet type, you know, Gambon's Dumbledore was like an old hippie with class, you know, this very chic, but also, you know, knowledgeable. So that it was a different take on it. Personally, I like Harris's version of Dumbledore better, but I still like Gambon, but, you know, that I like my Dumbledore as a book reader. I look at it more.
He's the OG.
OG. He's the OG. Absolutely.
Dame Maggie Smith as Minerva McGonagall. She was in 7 of the eight Harry Potter films. So she only almost appeared in all of them. Alan Rickman as Severus Snape. He appeared in all 8 Harry Potter films. Emma Thompson as Sybil Trelawney. She appeared in 3 of the films. She might be one of my favorite characters. She is so funny.
This was the first one she showed up in. Yeah, she's very good.
She's so good. And Timothy Spall as Peter Pettigrew, who would go on to appear in 6 of the Harry Potter films.
Perfectly cast as Peter Pettigrew, very talented actor. I always remember him as the kind of the sleazy manager and rock star, you know, but he's been a ton of stuff. He's great. He's so good.
I mean, we can't read the whole the credit list here. It just speaks to the ensemble. I mean, Alan Rickman, I mean, is just one of my favorites, as is Emma Thompson. And you have to, you know, honorable mention would go to Fiona Shaw and Richard Griffith as the Harry's aunt and uncle.
As the Dursleys. Yeah, they're so good.
Who appeared in 5 of the Harry Potter movies.
All right, stats and accolades from Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Release date June 4th, 2004. Going into this, you knew it was going to be a big hit. So it had a big budget, especially at the time, $130 million. Opening weekend, no surprise, number 1 at the box office with a take of $93.6 million in close to 4,000 theaters. It was number 1 for 2 weeks in a row. I mean, it was Harry Potter time, so there wasn't a ton of competition. I mean, it beat out Shrek 2 in its second week, and nobody wanted to really go up against it. Everybody was either before or after. It's Harry Potter. Domestically, it would go on to pull in $249.9 million. Worldwide take, $797.3 million, which does include some re-releases. Usually when they would have a new film come out, and especially with the end of the film, you know, the Deathly Hallows Part 2 coming out, they would do a lot of marathons nationwide or in other countries, to where they, for a week, you could go and see all of the previous Harry Potter films leading up to the new one.
That's more of an in-home marathon. I don't know who the hell would want to do that in a theater.
No. But the film itself is currently sitting at number 90 all-time worldwide list. So this is, And there's a lot of Harry Potters on that list, but this is a...
When it ranked number two at the box office for the year, home media, DVD and VHS release are in November of 2004. There was a two-disc special edition DVD and Blu-ray release in 2016. And then most recently, it was released on Ultra HD Blu-ray in 2017.
It's one where usually when it gets a re-release, I get it. I've purchased it in a Harry Potter set on DVD.
You got a DVD and digital, yeah.
I mean, I've done DVD, Blu-ray, and digital, so I've purchased the whole series at least three times.
And you own all the books.
Yeah.
This one movie has a running time of 2 hours and 22 minutes. I mean, that's got to be one of the longer Harry Potter films.
No, not really. I mean, when you get to the longer ones at this point, I mean, just being able to cut the book down to, you know, 2.5-ish hours is difficult to do. So it's about what, you know, what they are, between 2.5 and 3 hours, yeah.
With a rating of PG, it only has a body count of 3. Uncle Bilious, Binky the Rabbit, and Hagrid's Flubberworms. There's 12 of them. So actually, technically, there's 14. If you want to get
that. We're counting worms now? Okay.
Hey, man. Everybody counts or nobody counts. Bosh, baby. Scores of the film, Rotten Tomatoes, 90%. Cinema score, A, and a Metacritic of 82. Critics widely regard this Harry Potter installment as the best film in the franchise. It received universal acclaim for, as we've pointed out, the mature tone, but it also had complex storytelling that took the franchise to another level that we hadn't seen in the first two movies.
In my opinion, it is the best one in the film franchise. One of my favorite books as well. I'd say it's books 3, 4, and I mean, they're all really good, but books 3, 4, and 5 are peak Potter for me. And even Kwan, he has said that this is one of his favorite film and one of the best times of his life going back to direct it. So it comes across, and the critics saw it too.
Yeah, and he said he wanted to come back and do a sequel, but he ultimately never did. Ebert gave it 3.5 out of 4 stars, said, quote, not as good as the first two, but it found it delightful, amusing, and sophisticated.
I'm surprised he said the first two were better. Well,
yeah, I think maybe first impression, but aging the films in retrespect, Azkaban top of the list. Not only the one of the better films in the franchise, but it certainly has the highest replay value. Goblet of Fire is a close second on the replay Harry Potter list.
Yeah, whenever when my wife Kim, when she gets sick, she likes to cuddle up and watch Harry Potter, and typically it is Goblet of Fire, this one, Prisoner of Azkaban, or Order of the Phoenix, either 3, 4, or 5. I mean, those are the best.
Favorite books and the favorite movies, yeah. Awards of the film, 2 Oscar nominations, Best Score, John Williams, and Best Visual Effects. 4 BAFTA nominations, Best British Film, Best Production Design, Hair and Makeup, and Visual Effects. Another 17 wins and 45 nominations. Also had a Grammy nomination John Williams got for the score.
Music of the Year for 2004, Grammy Record of the Year, Here We Go Again by Ray Charles and Nora Jones. And then the Billboard Hot 100, which we've mentioned in past 2004 episodes. Big one everybody knows and remembers, Yeah by Usher featuring Little John and Ludacris. Doesn't hold up as well, but it's just more so nostalgic at this point.
Movies of 2004, top of the box office. Number one picture of 2004, Shrek 2.
I was wondering what number one was. Like, what could have beat out Harry Potter? Of course, Shrek.
Followed by number 3, Spider-Man 2. So, kind of some sequels there as the top films, which yeah. We covered
just last Spider-Man season.
The Incredibles at number 4, and The Passion of the Christ at number 5.
Good year for films in 2004.
That was a big hit. Yeah. Oscar Best Picture winner, Million Dollar Baby. It won 4 Oscars. Another big winner at the ceremony that year was Aviator, which won 5 Oscars.
Not one of my favorite Scorsese films, but I mean, it's just kind of a weird one for me. But
DiCaprio is really great.
He's great. Oh, yeah. I mean, he's great in everything.
He's terrific. And Razzie Worst Picture winner, Catwoman. With Halle Berry. not her best work. TV of the year, top scripted shows. Number 1, CSI. Number 2, Desperate Housewives. And number 3, CSI Miami.
Oh, my God.
Jesus. Emmy Best Comedy Series winner, Everybody Loves Raymond. The first comedy series to win the award in its final season since like 1981 or two. It was like the first time it had been done in years and years.
I figured Seinfeld would have won it this last year, but okay.
Oh, these awards, it just shows how stupid they are. Seinfeld only won Best Comedy Series one season.
Oh my God. And I know there's plenty of people out there that don't like Seinfeld, but...
Well, Friends only won one, too, and that's both of those shows should have won at least three.
Listen, as much as I like Friends, if you take the laugh track out of that show, it's not as funny as something like... I mean, Seinfeld is much better, but...
Oh, yeah, comedy-wise, Seinfeld's the GOAT. Man, Curb's so good, too. But come on, we're big Larry David Seinfeld fans. And the Emmy Best Drama Series winner, Lost, in its first season. Average movie ticket... price in 2004 was $6.21. Adjusted for inflation, that's $8.21 today. And events of 2004, the 2004 New England Patriots won their third Super Bowl in their fourth season, becoming a dynasty. And the Boston Red Sox won the World Series for the first time since 1918, breaking the curse of the Bambino. The Summer Olympics took place in Greece. Also at the Super Bowl, Janet Jackson briefly exposed her breasts at the halftime show, Nipplegate. That was a pretty big deal. Facebook, yeah, that was everywhere. Facebook was launched at Harvard first, then Ivy League schools, and then schools in the Northeast area before going nationwide. And President Bush beats John Kerry for his second term.
All right, let's talk about our best scenes and lines from Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. I had difficulty with both of these, so I'm still kind of deciding between two of them, so let's start with your runner-up for best scene worn.
God, make a decision. Come on, man. Runner-up best scene, it's when Harry and Buckbeak take flight over Hogwarts.
Ah, nice. I like that. Yeah, I had that as an honorable mention. Good moment.
It's an awesome moment. Great visuals. It's just fantastically shot, and it's just a happy moment in an otherwise pretty grim film.
there's some other good moments, but no. So, you know, you've had two Harry Potter films up to this point, and you know, one of the great things about seeing your favorite books, especially your favorite fantasy adventure books, on the big screen is bringing those wow moments to life. Now, you know, at this point, you've already done the basics of magic and Hogwarts. You've crossed a lot of those hoops, you know, those hurdles in the first two films, having those wow moments around the wizarding school and everything. And this was one that you got for the first time in Prisoner of Azkaban, showing that flight and having that with the hippogriff. That is a wow moment for sure, and a great one in this movie. So I see why you picked that as the runner-up. It's a good one. And that was, I almost had that as a runner-up, almost matched up there, but ultimately, I went with one that it was just, you know, it's just gratifying as a viewer, as a reader of the books, to seeing someone get what is owed to them. No one more so than Draco Malfoy when he gets punched by Hermione.
Malfoy, you're okay? Let's go.
Quick.
Let's go. Run.
Not a word to anyone, understood?
That felt good.
Not good. Brilliant.
Just that moment, because you want to punch Draco. He's an asshole, and you've wanted to for two films, and finally seeing someone give him his due.
Put
him in his place, and you know, very rarely will I say, you know, support resorting to violence, but it was cathartic to see Hermione do that. So that was my runner-up.
Sometimes in school kids, someone just needs to get someone just needs to get decked.
And he ran off crying like a little baby, so it was funny.
Yeah, but with a bully, totally justified. Yeah, go Hermione.
I think we're gonna match up on our winner, but go ahead. Let's.
Yeah.
Let's,
oh, dude, it's when Harry saves Sirius and his past self. Bust out the wand. It's a great moment. It's emotionally supercharged because the movie's been the movie earns it. Like, it really earns the moment. It's heroic, and it's fucking beautiful.
Any minute now. Right there. You'll see.
Harry, listen to me. No one's coming.
Don't worry, he will. He will come.
Yeah?
Sirius.
You're dying. Both of you. Harry!
I remember when I read this scene in the book, and it's written so well, like, you know, me, you're just so engrossed in the book. You're like, what's going to happen? Is James is going to show up and do the Patronus? And like, it's not, it's like kind of clicking. It's kind of like the end of Usual Suspects when you realize Verbal Kint is Kaiser Soze. Sorry, spoiler alert there. But when you at the same time are realizing that moment with Harry, and then just that, when he cries out Expecto Patronum, and cast the Patronus charm there. I wanted to mention this earlier for score, for the John Williams score, but didn't want to overshadow our best scene because I knew that we would match up on this one. Man, what a great choice.
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
Honestly, I only had one honorable mention. I had two, but you mentioned that the flying on Buckbeak was one. The other honorable mention that I had, again, I love this film, so it was hard for me to, I found myself, the list was getting too long, so I just wanted to pick out the ultimate favorites that could have very well even been runner-ups. But my last honorable mention was Lupin's lesson on the boggarts.
Now, can anybody tell me what a boggart looks like?
No one knows.
When she get here?
Boggarts are shapeshifters. They take the shape of whatever a particular person fears the most. That's what makes them so...
So terrifying, yes, yes, yes. Luckily, a very simple charm exists to repel a boggart. Let's practice it now. Without wands, please. After me. Ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
Very good. A little louder. Very clear. Listen. Ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
This class is ridiculous.
Very good.
Yeah, I want to play that fucking game, dude. Are you kidding me? Who doesn't want to do that? That's fun. Ridiculous.
What would come out of the chest for you?
Oh, I have no idea. Probably Jaws.
Probably Jaws. Man, me would probably be my kids with shit all over their clothes. Like, Daddy, help me.
Yeah, right. I mean, I had that as an honorable mention, and I had Hermione punching Malfoy as an honorable mention. So you have eliminated two of mine, so I only have one honorable mention.
Okay.
And it's the Dementors on Hogwarts Express. I mean, that is like the first moment in the Harry Potter franchise where you're like, whoa, this is fucking taking a turn.
Well, yeah, you've always looked at the Hogwarts Express as kind of this safe place for them to travel to school and kind of Harry and Ron and Hermione to kind of catch up. You didn't get that in the second film because of Dobby blocked it off and they had to take the car and everything. But you very much looked at this like, well, they're not at school yet, so nothing bad's going to happen. But now you kind of, they're crossing a line with the Dementors showing up. So
yeah, I mean, this scene, we talk about the movie having a darker tone, but this scene cements the darker tone.
Yes, yeah, so establishes that very early on. Yeah. All right. So moving on to our best lines from the film, I'll start with my runner up. It's the moment where Remus is about to turn into a werewolf and Sirius is trying to appeal to his humanity.
Remus, my old friend. Have you taken your potion tonight?
You know the man you truly are, Remus. This heart is where you truly live. This heart here. This flesh is only flesh.
The delivery by Oldman there, number one, there's just a lot of talent there. A lot of the emotion behind it shows that he's been through this before with his friend.
Oldman's going for an Oscar there.
Yeah, I mean, he's been through this moment before with his friend Remus Lupin and trying to keep him. He knows it's never worked in the past. It's not going to work this time to try to keep him from turning into a werewolf and succumbing to the call of the full moon. But just the way he delivers it, there's so much emotion and history behind it between the two characters.
I had that as an honorable mention.
Okay. What about your runner-up?
It was Snape speaking to Lupin, and it's really a great showcase of Snape's personality when he's like,
"Well, Lupin, out for a little walk in the moonlight, are we?"
It's like he knows.
Yeah, he knows. He knows he knows what time it is.
Even going back to earlier in the film, and it doesn't portray this in the film as much as it does the book, but Snape is a brilliant potions master, and he concocts a formula to help Remus Lupin through that. So he knows about Lupin's secret, and even when he goes to the defense against the dark arts class and steps in when Lupin has to take a day off due to his his full moon nature. He tries to teach the kids about werewolves, you know, and like Hermione figures it out, of course, because she's smart. So it's like, he knows, he's not trying to hide it. It's a good choice. All right. So for our winners, what was your winner?
It was by Lupin, and he was talking to Harry. He says,
"Well, I'm very impressed. That suggests that what you fear the most is fear itself. This is very wise."
Yeah, that's a good one. Mine was more of a heart-to-heart moment at the end of the film between Harry and Sirius when they connect for the first time.
"I expect you're tired of hearing this. But you look so like your father. Except your eyes."
"You have
my mother's eyes."
"It's cruel that I got to spend so much time with James and Lily and you so little. But know this. The ones that love us never really leave us. And you can always find them. In here."
Again, Gary Oldman going for broke and just delivering the goods, man. I mean, I can't ever remember him being bad at anything. He's just so terrific.
Real quickly, the only honorable mention that I had we had a lot of overlap between our honorable mentions and
winners. Yeah, you eliminated two of mine, yeah.
Yeah, so the only one that I had, and this may have been one of your honorable mentions as well, was by Dumbledore, a very quotable line from this film.
"But you know, happiness can be found even in the darkest of times, if one only remembers to turn on the light."
That was my last honorable mention. So I have no, this might be the first episode I have no honorable mentions because we've already eliminated them all. I had three coming into the episode, but they all three have been mentioned.
So did I. And we overlapped with each other so much. It's funny. Wow.
But no line matchups though. That much line overlap, no matchup.
Moving on to Judge Bob's Recasting Court, where Warren and I recast the film with today's stars. All rise for the Honorable Judge Bob, presiding.
Gentlemen, you may be seated. Recasting Court is now in session. Looked at the notes on this. We got a lot on the docket, gentlemen. Lot on the docket. In fact, we will be hearing recastings for Draco, Hagrid, McGonagall, Snape, Dumbledore, Professor Lupin, Sirius Black, Ron, Hermione, and Harry. That being said, make it take it rules puts this one in Warren's court. Let's start off with Draco. Warren, who do you got?
Well done. Even navigating that list of characters is not easy. So I commend you.
Well, listen, hey, McGonagall, Snape, and Dumbledore, professors too. You only said Professor Lee.
Yeah,
Lincoln,
yeah,
okay?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Take it easy. Fucking diehard Potter over here. All right. So for Draco, Harry's, you don't say nemesis, basically his rival, right? In school, his academic rival.
It's his nemesis, yeah,
okay,
for right, sure.
Okay. Thought about it and I settled on it pretty quickly once I came across the young actors. I went with the Crivetti twins.
That's funny. I actually also went with the Crivetti twins.
Again?
What? Did we just become best friends?
Yep.
Yeah, for Big Little Lies. Yeah.
Big Little Lies. They play the twins in there. I can't remember their names, but they're Skarsgård, Alexander Skarsgård, and Nicole Kidman's sons in that show. They just have the look, the Draco look. You know, this that kind of the Slytherin, I'm better than you type of personification.
Yeah, I think we're both guilty of the central casting headshot right there. Like they just look the part.
It's a big part of it with Draco. You got to, but yeah, no, I was like, well, you probably cast them both, but yeah, I did. That's funny. We both casted the twins because they seem to work together a lot, I guess, for the child actor roles and whatnot. But yeah, that was an easy pick.
Well, it's good when you have those limitations for kid actors where you have twins that can kind of share the workload.
Yeah.
Well done, gentlemen. Well done.
Making it easy on you.
Yeah, yeah. No decision to be made there. Moving on to Hagrid. Warren, who do you have?
Man, this came to me pretty quick. Talk about an actor. He's a jack-of-all-trades talent. He can sing. I mean, he's a host. He's an actor. I'm with James Corden. He just beaming enthusiasm for every project he takes on. He has this infectious quality, and I just think the energy he would bring to the movie and in that role would be great.
Thank you.
Okay.
I'll say my argument first. I had John Rhys-Davies, who I would say, I mean, he's been in quite a bit. He was Gimli in Lord of the Rings, but I mean, he's a very seasoned actor. He's done a lot. There is a deep baritone quality to Hagrid's voice. This just boisterous nature to him. He's a little clumsy, but gentle at heart. I mean, Hagrid is one of my favorite characters in the Harry Potter series, and John Rhys-Davies, I think, fit that very well. James Corden, and I hate to say this, Warren, you're a great recaster, but this is probably one of your worst, is just a complete wrong
fuck
fit.
You, motherfucker.
This is a complete something. Wrong fit.
Let me tell you something. James Corden is great, man, all right? Now, I don't know the Potterverse like you do, so maybe you're just flexing your Potter nerd muscles right now, but I can easily see him in the part watching the movie.
Well, no, there's just too much of a goofy quality to Corden. I mean, he's a comedic actor, and I'm not saying he doesn't have the skill to, but that's not what you want in your Hagrid.
All right, we're not going to invest any more time in this one. JRD is going to take it all the way. I really don't have any idea how Warren landed on James Corden. Love him to death. But man, Hagrid?
Not a good fit.
Hagrid?
No.
Did you see him in the Friends reunion? He was fucking great.
I'm not objecting him. It's just he's not a good fit for this.
Did you see him in Cats? That's all that really matters.
If we didn't have 10 characters to recast, I would spend more time just blasting that pick. But we got to move on. So,
fuck you both.
All right. McGonagall, Phil, let's go. Who do you get?
McGonagall, I mean, you have to have an actress in this role that can, I mean, she's essentially the teacher, the head of House Gryffindor.
Deputy headmistress.
Right, that's what I'm saying. But I mean, she's also the one that's over Gryffindor as well. I mean, she's can keep the kids in line, very intelligent, smart. I mean, just a quick wit. Dame Judi Dench was my pick.
And Warren,
Okay.
Who do you have here, buddy?
We ultimately plucked from the same tree, I feel like, because I started to think of Viola Davis.
Mm-hmm.
I really would love her in this, but I had to settle with Dame Helen Mirren. I mean, fucking, she's so great at playing these type of characters, and I just think she would. You need this actress to have some, for lack of a better word, gravitas in the role. I mean, she's got to bring some weight with the character, and Helen Mirren brings that.
Yeah, both very capable. You can't go wrong with either. I mean, because we kind of plucked from the same tree there, I can't fault you because it's just a matter of preference at that point.
They both would be great. But I think Mirren would be better.
All right.
Love them both. I really hate you guys for putting both of these down to the decision. Why I ended up casting or selecting Judi Dench over Helen Mirren is Helen has a little bit more of a playful demeanor off screen. She's beloved by everyone. There's certain things about her, and Judi Dench, when she walks on set, she is in command. They both are. I don't know if it makes sense. There's
Helen Mirren played the fucking queen. She played the queen.
M for McGonagall. All right. M for McGonagall.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Jesus.
Keep going. Who do you have for Snape?
Snape, there is really the only adjective I can use to describe him initially and how Alan Rickman played him so masterfully is there is a broodiness to Severus Snape. I mean, he's very, very intelligent. He is just not afraid to keep slap a kid with a piece of notebook paper, his sleeve, whatever, to keep him in line. He's got the qualities of a House Slytherin. I mean, you could just hear him, Ronald Weasley, you know, he just that quiet, subdued brooding. And I went with Cillian Murphy for my Snape.
A little young for Snape. I think a little young. I mean, what's the age gap there? Rickman was a lot older. I went with Edward Norton. And the reason why is Edward Norton is one of those actors very much like Rickman who can play good guys and bad guys, but he can appear to be bad even when he's ultimately revealed to be good. And that's one of my favorite reveals in the Harry Potter franchise is how they make Snape look like he's a bad guy. And then it reveals he like did a great act of love and is deep down like an amazing person. So that reveal, I don't even know the details of it. It's just so memorable. I know that about that character in the movies, Alan Rickman playing Snape. So for that very reason, I think Edward Norton would be able to pull off that reveal.
Well, I mean, you talk about the age thing. Norton's 51, Killian's 45, so they're pretty close. I mean, you just basically need them to be a generation removed from.
Yeah, but audiences know Norton a lot more than they do Murphy. I mean, we've got some adventures built up with Norton. So
not a bad choice. Not a bad choice at all. Edward Norton is a fantastic actor, one of the best of his generation. I just think when you have there's a look to Snape, and I'm not getting back to the central casting thing, but when you brooding quality.
Throw a fucking wig on Norton, he's fine.
No, I'm not. It's facial.
Norton can do it all.
Facial. I'm just saying.
Norton can do it all, dude. He's got range.
And so is Killian Murphy. I'm just saying it's a great pick.
So the recent study news, what's been out with why Norton was dropped from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, leads me to Killian Murphy on this one. I think that Norton has too much gravitas, too much power to change script, and too much influence on the script that he probably would not fit into something like a Potterverse. Killian Murphy it is.
Thank you. That's a good point, actually. You know, yeah, because this is one where you very much there's source material.
Yeah, I think it's a different situation, though. I mean, Potter is very much a big train that was moving. As we're on Hulk, he was a producer, and they were trying to get this thing off the ground. The MCU wasn't established, so it was very much they didn't know what was going to work or what was going to be a flop. I mean, superhero movies were not a guaranteed hit at that point. So you rightfully so, Norton wanted to have more control.
Well, I think Norton
movies back then for actors.
Well, Norton's also much more of a creative. He gets behind the camera. He's more of a director writer. He likes a lot of control. I would say so in his projects. It's a great choice. I mean, I love Norton.
All right, keep it moving. Phil Dumbledore, who do you got?
You know, you got two iterations of Dumbledore out there, you know, the Richard Harris, the Michael Gambon. Which do you prefer? Me personally, I preferred the soft, silent, you know, but very much in control, powerful version that Richard Harris played in the first two films. I went with Anthony Hopkins, Sir Anthony Hopkins. He just has that quiet, reserved class to him where you never feel like anything gets by him, and he is can easily be the best wizard in the world.
Warren, who do you have here?
For Dumbledore, and I, as great as Hopkins is, I think you just go with an actor who's Hopkins tends to carry projects and be the main focal point, as where someone like Ian McKellen really fits into ensembles. I think he would be perfect for this. I just realized he played Gandalf in Lord of the Rings. I mean,
oh, you so just he, realized you know, that? You just realized
well, no,
that?
Just putting that together, though. I mean, I think that's more or less Dumbledore is cut from the same cloth. So I almost went with Morgan Freeman, but I love McKellen because of his stage work. And so I leaned within McKellen.
Real quick, I will say that you can't have Gandalf also be Dumbledore. You can't do that. You can't.
You can't 20 years later.
He turned it down when they were casting Michael Gambon because, you know, he didn't want to have the association of playing two very similar characters. And I don't even care as a fan 20 years later. I don't want to see the same actor as Gandalf and Dumbledore.
Yeah, I talked to him now. He's got a Malibu beach house to pay for. You know, I love how actors say they will play something, and then 15, 20 years go by, they're not as relevant. They got stuff to, and then all of a sudden they're doing it again. I mean, how many times did Patrick Stewart say he wasn't going to play Professor X, and then he kept doing it?
That's the same character, though.
I can't see Anthony Hopkins in the role. Warren takes it.
No. Yeah. Oh, my
yeah.
God.
I mean, the fact that Ian McKellen was in the running to replace it back then actually proves how perfect he is for it.
No way. You can't have Gandalf beat Dumbledore. Whatever.
You can't 20 years later. Oh, coming from the guy who wanted Winter Soldier to be fucking Batman. Okay, while he's got a show airing on Disney Plus. No, it's not. That is blasphemous.
That's different.
Okay, dumbass.
Whatever.
Moving on. Professor Lupin. Warren, who do you have?
Lupin, one of my favorite characters in the movie, man. I was going to go with Ewan McGregor, but I did a pivot last minute. Martin Freeman.
Another Lord of the Rings pulled Bilbo.
No, he's the Hobbit, right? Okay, there you go.
Yeah, he's Bilbo in the Hobbit. Yeah, sure.
Well, I almost went with Obi-Wan Kenobi. So it's like nowadays you're casting an actor; they've almost all played someone iconic before. So it's really hard. What do you get?
It was actually really hard to pull from some actors that have never been in a Harry Potter film before. That was the hardest thing for me.
All right, Phil, who do you have?
Well, love Martin Freeman. I loved him in. Like we said, The Hobbit films, you know, playing Dr. Watson and the Sherlock TV series with Benedict Cumberbatch. There is a certain unkempt quality to Remus Lupin. He's intelligent and warm and compassionate, especially to Harry. But at the same time, you know, he's got a history there. And there's, of course, the werewolf side. I went with Chiwetel Ejiofor, best known for 12 Years a Slave. He played opposite Benedict Cumberbatch as well in Doctor Strange. And there's just this professorial quality.
Okay, we know who the fuck he is. Okay, get to the point.
Anyway, there's just a professorial quality to him. And I just love him as a fit for the Lupin role.
I mean, I love him as an actor, but I just think of Martin Freeman in the first season of Fargo being a fumbling Lupin in a sense. And I just think Freeman would be great in the part because he's got that heart of gold, but also showing the depth to be capable of doing more.
Just because I don't even know that Phil wanted to actually cast Chiwetel. I think he just wanted to flex his ability to enunciate names. I'm going to give it to Warren for that.
What?
Yeah.
No, he's a great guy
for it. You know,
I don't even know if I'm saying his name right, actually. I could be completely butchering it.
Well, great actor. I know that I can't say his name right, and for that, Warren, good job. Who do you have for Sirius Black?
Nice, I'll take it. Harry's godfather. I went, this may be giving an apple to the judge here, but I thought of one of your favorite actors, and I just set a perfect villain for this, Javier Bardem. I mean, come on, man, he's perfect. He'd be just that level of creepiness, and there's this Colonel Kurtz element, Brando and Apocalypse Now, with this character where they're building up to him appearing. And dude, Javier Bardem, come on. He'd be great.
All right, Phil.
Well, number one, he's not the villain. Yeah.
But it makes you think that in the marketing, but he's okay. Later revealed not to be. Yeah.
Or whatever.
Because he's out to kill Harry. That's why they investigate the mysterious prisoner.
You know, Gary Oldman himself has gone on record saying, you know, how difficult of a role this was as far as with the dialogue and just acting in this film. Gary Oldman, one of the best actors of all time. You know, especially in these types of supporting roles, there's a look to Sirius Black as far as just like the kind of disheveled, almost sullen escapee from Azkaban. I went with Sam Rockwell, another great actor of our generation, Academy Award winner. Can just jump into any role.
I think the perennial supporting actor of the day. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, exactly, and that's why you need such a strong anchor because the movie is really centered around Sirius Black, and that's why I picked him.
All right, like you're pulling one of my Meisner actors, so you know I'm gonna love some Sam Rockwell. Okay, I've loved him since Iron Man 2 when he did the dance on stage. I'm like, what the hell is that? I love it.
He's great in anything.
You love Rockwell, yeah, he's so great. I mean, actually, his first time is Green Mile. When he plays the fucked up prisoner and it's later revealed that he killed the twins and it shows him cutting into the screen door. I mean, just how visceral that is. I mean, the Sam Rockwell playing that character is seared into my memory. That's how great of an actor he is. So love the choice.
He is a lot of different faces and he can just inhabit any role. Yeah.
But I just think Bardem has that darkness and that edge and that quality where you don't know a lot about him is he's going to be able to fill in.
I like Bardem if he actually turned out, if Sirius Black didn't turn out to be a good guy. Like if Black stayed, if Sirius Black stayed to be a villain, yeah, Bardem's perfect for it. Yeah.
I think it just makes the reveal all the much better.
The answer I was looking for here is Kevin Bacon. That being said,
Bacon. Oh my God.
Sam Rockwell is going to take this one. Well done.
Yeah, I was going to say, you save Sam Rockwell, we get him using one time all season. I was using him.
I feel that way for Javier Bardem. I love that guy. It pained me.
God damn it.
To make that selection. God, I love
Bardem. Yeah, I really love hate wasting him. I hate wasting him. Damn it.
Okay. Let's get to Ron Weasley here. Phil, who do you have?
Ronald Weasley. Leviosa. No, I a little recency bias with this one. I mean, now that we're getting into Ron, Hermione, and Harry, these are for the most part. I mean, they are child actors. It's difficult to cast. I mean, coming into this is the third film in the franchise, so you have to do one that's age appropriate, but also one that could have been undiscovered. So it's a little bit of a tightrope act picking the right actor. It couldn't go too big. I went with Noah Jupe. I would say best known for the Quiet Place films. He plays the son in those, and maybe it is a little recency bias. I just saw Quiet Place Part 2. He's fantastic in that. But J.K. Rowling is very descriptive with her characters, and they have to have a certain look. And he has the look that could be the Ron Weasley. So you know, he's best friend of Harry, but he's got that quality where he is a little
Yeah. We get the fucking picture. Sorry, go ahead. Okay, yeah, all right. So I thought of Noah Jupe because, you know, we're picking from such a small pool here.
And we tapped it out pretty hard with Sandlot. So, you know.
No shit. So under 16, I'm thinking actor-wise, you're okay. They're playing 13, and most of the actors in real life are between 14 and 15 playing him. So anything under 16 is acceptable, I think. However, for my Weasley, I went with Evan Alex, most known from the movie Us. He's 13, so age-wise, he's perfect. Up-and-coming actor, not too many previous associations, which the actors didn't have in real life. And I certainly, you know, I don't think you want to cast a kid actor who's about to do 8 of these movies that's too known for something else. So I think he's perfect. He's an up-and-comer. He's got the goods, and I think he'd be great in the part.
I'm going to go ahead and give this one to Phil. Well done. Good argument.
Thank you.
Oh, I just lost.
Moving on. To our tiebreaker, should we need her?
Nope, we don't. I just lost.
That was over.
Weasley was my last chance. I needed to run the table to have a shot.
Phil, who do you have for Hermione?
For Hermione, to me, this was the hardest one to recast, just because, I mean, there's an intelligent...
Okay, let's not bask in your victory.
All right,
let's
fine. I'll be quick about it. I do want to give credit where credit's due. It's a great character. Hermione's very intelligent. I mean, for all intents and purposes, I mean, geez, yes, one of the three kids, but she's the leader. More so in this film, she carries it.
She's the trio's brains.
Yeah, exactly. I went with McKenna Grace.
Oh, man, like the perennial actress of her age. Yeah, how many actors has she played the young version of in movies? It's ridiculous.
Carol
it's
Danvers like in Captain Marvel, Tanya Harding in iTanya. I mean, quite a bit. I mean, she is.
It goes on and on and on.
Going to be a name, a household name that everyone knows. If she is,
she already is, but she's going to be big time. Well, you know me, I'm a Tarantino aficionado, and any chance I have to cast this actress, I'm going to take it. I don't think it quite worked out for me with E.T. when I tried to pivot with her.
The worst ever.
But
oh, my God.
Julia Butters as Hermione is fucking fantastic. She's got that sass in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She's able to stand toe-to-toe with DiCaprio and put him in his place. If she can do that to DiCaprio, she can handle Harry Potter and Weasley. Come on, man. Julia Butters is perfect as Hermione.
All right. So she just turned 12 like a couple of months ago. And if you were launching the franchise, like if you started with Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, the first, Julia Butters all the way, I will hand it to you. She is a fantastic pick for Hermione to carry your franchise. Not for Prisoner of Azkaban. She's just not quite in that age range. And just based upon this
the characters are 13.
But do you know how I don't think you know how kids work, man. It's like you can't do a 5-year-old last year and then a 14-year-old this year. It doesn't work.
Hey,
that
man,
way.
I obviously didn't work out for me last year, so I'm getting close. Dude, that isn't a fair example because this is much closer. I mean, the character's 13. She's really 12.
It's
right,
close.
She's perfect for
order,
it. Everybody's perfect.
Order in the court. Order in the court here. Julia brings more of a uniqueness, which Hermione was. And so
right.
I like the Julia Butters.
That,
I like
that.
It
actually
is going to take this
good.
One.
Terrible.
You were trying to DQ it
she's
on a
not,
fucking age
no,
difference of a year.
She just turned 12.
Dude,
she's not old
won.
Enough.
Let me get some points in garbage time. Shut the fuck
it
up.
Doesn't,
take
Matt,
the
it,
W.
No. Oh, my God.
Dude, let me get a few yards here. I'm Matt Ryan, okay? I just threw a 60-yard pass.
It doesn't matter.
I'm down 28.
Terrible choice. Oh, my God. Normally, I'll let it go, but that's awful. Sorry.
No, it's not. It's not. She's perfect for it. You're fucking wrong.
She's
you're
perfect for it in The
age.
Sorcerer's Stone in the first film, yes. Not age-appropriate for Prisoner of Azkaban. This is a more mature step for the Harry Potter franchise. Whatever.
And for the last casting of today's hearing, we'll have Harry Warren. Balls in your court. Who do you have?
Harry Potter. I went with Ian Armitage from Young Sheldon. Big Little Lies. This I think, you know, he's led a series. Let's give him a shot. He's been in big projects. Let's give him a shot as a lead in a film. I think he's up to the task. He's very good at playing sophisticated and smart. And, you know, as where Sheldon is unique, so is Harry Potter.
Phil, who's your counter here?
For Harry Potter, the boy who lived, you know, you're looking for a face that can carry the franchise, someone that it's got a somewhat of a nerdy quality to him, but he can also be the star athlete on the Quidditch team. He's got the kind of a mixture of both. He's
a dork even when he's doing
that.
That's
a common misconception. You think Harry Potter's a dork. He was a dork to Dudley Dursley before he went to Hogwarts, but he's very much a popular kid. I mean, he's Harry fucking Potter. So I went with Roman Griffin Davis. I feel a very talented actor, could carry the franchise and has both sides of it and has the emotional weight to be a great Harry Potter.
Love it. Love all of it. Jojo Rabbit versus young Sheldon. I mean, guys, great castings. I love it. Good for you. Young Sheldon's going to take this one. Well done.
What the fuck?
Oh my God. That is so terrible.
Well, you know what? You got the W, but I at least got the two of the main characters.
I mean, a win's a win, but I'm very disappointed.
I am a golden god!
Recasting court is adjourned.
All right, fan theory time. I was expecting not to pull up a lot that was unique to Prisoner of Azkaban. Yeah, I know there's fan theories out there for the Harry Potter series as a whole. I mean, it's Harry Potter. When you have something this rich of content and history, you're going to have fan theories. However, there were more than a couple specific to this film, and I picked out my favorite here, which is, so there is a, and some of this is going to tie into the book. I kind of had to have the overlap between the film and the book to include it. But the fan theory is that, and I'm going to say that if you haven't read Harry Potter, this is a major, major spoiler for the books and the film. So skip ahead to like 3 minutes before listening, because it's a huge, huge spoiler. Okay, here I'm going to go with the spoiler. 3, 2, 1. The fan theory goes that in this book, this story, Prisoner of Azkaban, that the death of Dumbledore, which occurs in the sixth, was predicted. And it was predicted by Professor Trelawney when they're at a Christmas dinner and 12 are seated at the table, and Trelawney shows up and Dumbledore's just like, oh, you know, Sybil, please join us. And she says, oh, you know, when 13 people dine together, the first to rise will die. So she didn't want to be the 13th and, you know, curse someone to death because she, you know, believes in all that shit. However, the theory is that Scabbers, the rat, was in Ron's pocket. So there was already 13 people at the table when Dumbledore stood up, and he was indeed the first one to die from that group.
Huh. Yeah, I buy that.
Buy that? Okay. All right. It's a little bit of a stretch. I mean, to kind of, you have to make the assumption that
I'm not really the authority on the Potter universe.
you'll take my word for it.
Wizarding World of Potter.
And this is further supported by, there's a fan site, you know, someone added on that, well, also in Order of the Phoenix, there's 13 people sitting down to eat, and Sirius Black steps up, stands up, and he dies. He's the first to die. He dies later. And there is a somewhat of a precedent there of this foreshadowing to a character death. But just the fact that they would do such a huge one as Dumbledore in, you know, book three, when it doesn't happen until book six or film, whatever you want to look at, film three and film six. But yeah, pretty interesting.
And we'll close out the episode discussing the legacy of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. I mean, when you look at the themes of the movie, just a lot of big ones, good versus evil, fear, justice, injustice, transformation. You know, you get the Pettigrew into the rat, Sirius into the dog, and you got the Lupin into the wolf. I mean, that's a consistent running theme through the film. Friendship and loyalty and family ties. And of course, time, you know, with Hermione messing with the traveling and going to all the classes at once.
Well, the transformation of the kids from children into teenagers, to take that one as well. So, I mean, yeah, the transformative theme of the film is very much present, in the sense that the franchise itself, along with the children, are transitioning into a more mature path.
And as we mentioned, the third of eight feature films, the feature film franchise starting in 2001 and ending in 2011. So essentially a decade, a 10-year period where they were releasing these movies. This is the third highest grossing film franchise of all time, $7.7 billion. Do you want to take a crack at who's number one and who's number two?
And are you counting the MCU as a film franchise?
Yeah, they're number one, absolutely.
All right, yeah. So if you're counting that, yeah, that's absolutely number one.
They're like $22 billion.
Number two, it's not Lord of the Rings, is it?
Nope, Star Wars.
Star Wars, okay. Yeah, that was going to be my second guess. Yeah, that should have been my first. I'm an idiot.
And they're currently doing the spinoff prequel series. They've already released, two of the films so far, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them in 2016, and Fantastic Beasts and the Crimes of Grindelwald in 2018. And the spinoff prequel series is planned for 5 movies. So far, 10 major motion pictures have been released that take place in the Harry Potter universe.
And, you know, there is a website called Pottermore where, I mean, there's a lot of other content like prequels and other things that could be written. And I don't know how much of a fan I am of it. I mean, they had, at this point, we're talking about the legacy of the whole franchise. I mean, you had the stage adaptation, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, you know, so it's going in a direction where as a purist Harry Potter fan, I'm not sure that I like. I feel like they should have just left it alone, at least for a little while. I mean, they jumped into the Fantastic Beasts. I mean, within a few years, I mean,
yeah, you gotta strike while the iron's hot, man.
It's Harry Potter. The iron's always going to be hot, you know, and I don't think that again, yeah, I get it. You want to capitalize on it, keep the marketing machine going. But, you know, it's at some point you want to make sure you're focusing on the quality of it and not forcing stories.
Well, if they reboot the Harry Potter movies, then you know they're forcing it for sure. Anytime soon, anyways.
Well, if they reboot as a movie, yes, but it would be nice to see it as a...
Oh, my God, shut up. You're such a Harry Potter dork.
No, you want more material.
Did you get emotional at the end of the last one? They show him at the train station picking up his kids and stuff. I bet that really all the Harry Potter fans out there really touched him.
No, not.
Did you like the ending? No.
I mean, it's weird. I feel like they shouldn't have used the same actors and tried to age them. It just felt weird. Looking at that,
cast the kids. That's weird.
Yeah, doing the cast of the kids and trying to make them look older. It didn't land for me, I feel like, the way that it did in the book when I read it. So I would like to see it done as a television series to do the longer books justice. There's just no way you're going to be able to fit, even Azkaban, which is not an incredibly long book.
You can make each book a season.
Well, wow, what a brilliant idea. I'm sure no one's... No, but I'm saying
that's actually... getting what that's like what you do 10 episodes focus on each book. I mean, that should cover it.
Even for some of them you could do season part one, part two, kind of like you've done another TV series in the past. I mean, some of them are incredibly long.
It's funny you mentioned that, the part one and part two, because one of the biggest impacts this film had was how they split the finale into two movies, part one, part two. We saw Twilight and Hunger Games follow suit after this franchise elected to do that. And it's more of a way to milk the get an extra movie out of it. But the success of this franchise led to books being adapted. So you wouldn't have Twilight and Hunger Games if it wasn't for the success of Harry Potter. And Lord of the Rings. You got to give Lord of the Rings credit.
Well, I mean, I get what you're saying. I mean, Lord of the Rings, the books had been out there at that point for 70 years or so. Whereas, Harry Potter was much more geared towards the young adults, in the same way that Twilight and Hunger Games were. So those have more in common as more of a contemporary book franchise adapted for a film series. And that's how it would differ from Lord of the Rings, but you're right. It did definitely start that trend and kept it going, especially, this one being book three. Eventually they'd make 8 films, 2-part finale, which, for better or for worse became the trend. Mainly for worse, but you even saw ones that weren't as successful, like the Divergent series and others that
this movie really helped redefine the Hollywood blockbuster and more or less shifted the studios really shifted the gear further in the direction towards IP, going with what I would more or less quantify as blue chip stock for a movie studio, where you've got, you know, an established property with a built-in fan base.
We would see that with films before, like with, say, with Jaws, the last episode we did. There's a book there, an IP, but you can't build a franchise around it because there's only one book. And then, like,
they tried.
Well, yeah, exactly. So you force these gloriously. Sequels. You force these sequels and these, maybe these even book sequels that just don't work out. Whereas with you've got a mapped plan that Rowling had, you know, with the book series, and that, you know, we had something similar with Game of Thrones, but it wasn't finished. That roadmap wasn't done. But the part that was done, you built a fan base off of.
Yeah, you look at great film franchise achievements, like testaments to being able to pull it off. And I would say the first three phases of the MCU has got to be number one, man. But I mean, Harry Potter, this is a glorious achievement for cinema, that they were able to pull this off and to do it well, where every installment is of a certain quality. I mean, there's not a stinker in the bunch. I mean, some are better than others, and that's more of a preference thing, but they're all really good.
And this one, more so because of the director they had, Alfonso Cuarón, but this one elevated the quality of it and showed, you know, that these were not only great fantasy films, but ones that were well made.
Talking about the impact, it had a lot of, for a film that's relatively not that old, it's got quite a few connections. It's been spoofed in Shrek the Third, SNL, Anchorman 2, and Robot Chicken. It was referenced in Pineapple Express, Yes Men, Jeopardy, and Parks and Rec. Just a handful. There's quite a few more, but, you know.
I mean, Harry Potter is a franchise. Yeah, it's got many, many references, so it's not surprising there. But to me, this one will always stand out as my favorite, as I mentioned earlier, because of the shift to the more mature, darker tone that, as you read the books, as a reader, you felt like you matured with the kids and what they were going through. And this was the first book film to step into that direction.
To bridge that gap, yeah. All-time list, AFI nominated the movie for two lists, the top 100 movies and the top 10 fantasy films. So of the Harry Potter franchise, this movie was nominated for two of the AFI lists. Speaks to the greatness of the franchise, but this movie in particular, that it was singled out like this. It won this movie the first Light Awards by children ages 5 to 15. It was voted Film of the Decade in 2011.
Wow.
Movie Phone ranked it number 10 for the decade. IGN ranked it the fifth best fantasy film. And Empire ranked it number 471 on the top 500 movies list of all time.
Goblet of Fire gets a lot of praise as being the best of the series, the best film. I mean, it's got the Triwizard Tournament, and there's a lot of cool aspects of it. But, you know, to me, Prisoner of Azkaban has got to be the peak, because it's the one that started it down that tone of quality with the more mature themes.
And Michael Retchafin of The Hollywood Reporter summed it up best when he said, quote, a deeper, darker, visually arresting, and more emotionally satisfying adaptation of the J.K. Rowling literary phenomenon, achieving the neat trick of remaining faithful to the spirit of the book while at the same time being true to its cinematic self, unquote.
That is going to do it for this episode of Replay Value. Thank you so much for listening. The Replay Value podcast is hosted by me, Philip Reinerson, and my brother, Warren Paul. Our recasting judge is Bob Thompson. Produced, edited, and directed by Waldo Pickles Productions, and dedicated to our father, who we have to thank for our love of cinema. Please be sure to subscribe to the podcast, and if you like what you hear, take the time to rate, review, and share with a friend. You can visit us on our website, replayvaluepod.com, and follow us on Twitter at replayvaluepod. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every other Tuesday, and we'll see you then.
Bye! Bye.
This has been a Waldo Pickles production.